What is behind the genocidal hate campaign that encourages the killing of white farmers? I'm sure many of you have heard the or seen the video. Let me see if I can relate that to you here. Kill the Boer, kill the farmer. This is Sky News.
We have a long way to go before we reach the frightening depth of societal decline occurring in some other parts of the world, like South Africa, where political leaders chant about genocide, about killing white farmers in stadiums full of reporters. That was the leader of the Economic Freedom Fighters Party, Julius Malema, and if you think he is even a little bit sorry about it, then think again.
I will sing this song even when I feel like. It's not my song, it's a struggle song.
Now this chant of killing the Boers, killing the white farmers, is being presented as just a civil rights anti-apartheid chant. As if that shocking history of farmers being targeted in brutal attacks where they are robbed, tortured, and in some cases murdered, but that's never happened. These attacks are real, and yet this murderous chant is not only tolerated, but celebrated by some race-baiting miscreants. In the space of a week in June this year, there were 7 farm murders, and these cases are horrific, including Pierre and Belinda de Kock, who were murdered on their farm in Pickettburg in the Western Cape, their bodies found with stab wounds to the neck. That was within days of one of the most sickening attacks where Anik and Henny Klassen, both in their 70s, were tortured before being set on fire while still alive. 7 farm murders in the space of a week. These people are real, these farm attacks are real, and have been happening for several years now, but South Africa's Equality Court ruled just last year that chants about killing farmers were not hate speech. And leader of the Economic Freedom Fighters Party, Julius Malema, wants you to know things can get worse. Listen to this incredible interview where he says, "We have not called for the killing of white people, at least for now, but we can't guarantee what will happen in the future.
Let's get our land and let's wake our land. I'm hated for that. What? Where? I mean, I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I'm saying to you, we have not called for the killing of white people, at least for now. I can't guarantee the future."
Yeah, but I mean, you'd understand somebody watching that, especially as it gets shared on Twitter, they freak out. It sounds like a genocidal.
Crybaby.
I'm not calling for the slaughter of white people, at least for now.
I can't give you a guarantee of the future, especially when things are going the way they are.
Can't give a guarantee of the future, genocidal.
Crybabies.
If you don't like genocide, what's wrong with you? There you go, nothing to worry about there. And since that clip of the stadium chant went viral, we've seen the usual suspects in the Western media defend the call to kill white farmers. Look at this disgraceful bit of work in the New York Times. Despite numerous farm murders in South Africa, the New York Times pretends Kill the Boer is just an anti-apartheid chant that is needlessly upsetting right-wing commentators. This would be the same New York Times that sees racism everywhere, including in the OK hand signal. Yeah, that's racism. That's suddenly a hate crime. As is saying all lives matter or saying white lives matter, that's hate. The chanting about killing Boers, killing the white farmers, shoot to kill, well, that's just harmless political chants. Don't go getting all hysterical about it. If you can't find out to test the very real, very dangerous anti-white racism, the dehumanisation and degradation of people based on nothing other than the colour of their skin, then you haven't been paying attention.
Well, but not often that we would turn to the Australians to get accurate news, but there we go. Australians have called it quite well on that one. So, Julius Malema leads 90,000 of his supporters on the 10th birthday of the EFF. Can you believe the EFF's 10 years old? Well, I don't think their political maturity is much above that either. And there they are chanting away, kill the Boer, kill the farmer. And that word in between that you might have missed is a mandla, a mandla's power, along with a clenched fist. A mandla, shoot to kill, kill the Boer, kill the farmer. And the EFF, they meant to stand for economic freedom parties. I think it stands for the everything for free party. They want free land, free tertiary education, free everything. And Julius Malema has been popular for all of his rhetorical anti-white racism and expropriation without compensation demands. He's also made blasphemous statements like, I am the Messiah of our time. I will give free land to my people. Unlike Jesus or Nelson Mandela and his friends, I don't need to go to a stupid prison to save my people. So, he thinks he's the Messiah. Well, of course, he's a false Messiah. EFF is often choosing white. Red is the color, but how do you like this character in University of Cape Town, pictured with his kill all whites sitting in the main cafeteria? Now imagine if you've got a kill all anything else type of t-shirt. Would that have attracted anything else? You know, kill all Asians, kill all Jews. Would that create any kind of upset in kill all blacks? Would that be something shocking? Would they call that hate speech? But the man could sit in the University of Cape Town, just up the hill here, kill all whites. And H.G. Wells made the statement, racism justifies and holds together more baseness, cruelty and abomination than any other sort of error in the world. The great thing about racism is it demonizes those who differ from you. Now, how do you like this? Published in Harvard Magazine in 2002, Professor Noel Ignatieff. The goal of abolishing the white race is on its face so desirable that some may find hard to believe that it could incur any opposition other than from committed white supremacists. Make no mistake about it, we intend to keep on bashing the dead white males and the live ones too, and the females too, until the social construct known as the white race is destroyed. Make no mistake, we want to get rid of all white people. In fact, this has been said by so many different professors. There are many people advocating we need to abolish all white people, and that some have even spoken very clearly. The way we're doing this is bombard the people with propaganda about overpopulation, support abortion, support sterilization, support euthanasia, and of course LGBTQ alternative lifestyles and perversion, and transgender surgeries, which effectively sterilizes people, castrate the males, sterilize the women, have mastectomies, cut off women's breasts, genital mutilation, effectively sterilize them, and replace them with hordes of people from third world nations that can be easier manipulated in order to vote for their parties, and in time you will see an end to white racism. In fact, some people have said it this bluntly, white women can at least be used to produce brown babies, but white males are good for nothing but fertilizer. All you can do is kill them and put them in the ground. And there's people talk like that, professors of universities, editors, even ministers of the church. Now, these things are based on a bunch of lies. And there's a bunch of blatant lies told about our history to justify this hatred for all whites. I mean, I've had from early on being told that whites, even the whites who came to Africa, came to oppress the people. Well, my parents were good people. My father and mother taught me to respect and love and be kind to the local people, the Matabele in Zimbabwe, where I grew up in what then was Rhodesia. They taught us to be polite, to be thoughtful. Many of the hotel staff would come to my mother regularly at night if they had a problem. I remember one man coming with a machete stuck in his head. Madam, do you have an aspirin? My mother, being a nurse, was commonly called upon, and she brought him into the kitchen, had him sit down, and then as she removed the machete from his head, he saw some blood fall on his knee, and then he fainted. And of course she gave him more than aspirin, but still. My dad would regularly be driving him to the hospital or whatever was needed, like our family car was the local taxi. I saw my parents caring for the local people, but according to the media, my parents were evil colonials. But as they said, they were encouraged by their governments, like the British government, to go to Africa to help develop and to bless the people in Africa, to raise up the standards of living. So the very governments that demonized us and demonized my parents encouraged them to come out to Africa to help civilize the continent, improve education, improve the economy, provide jobs for people. And then later they were hated by the very governments they'd fought for. Now my dad had fought all 6 years in the Second World War in the British 8th Army, and the British government sent him out to Rhodesia, and next thing he knows he's catering for the royal family, and he's a hero of Great Britain at the time, but just a few years later he becomes an evil racist colonialist because he's in a country that the British told him to go to raise the standards of living and to provide employment and all this. So there's a lot of lies being told about the past in order to justify the evil people on the gravy train today. So first of all, just understand South Africa today is a failed state of the communist ANC, and now their goal is white genocide and diaspora. Diaspora meaning there are now more white South Africans living outside South Africa than living within South Africa. At this moment, there's something like 10% of New Zealand are South Africans. The whole community is dominated by South Africans. There are some of the largest churches in London, say, are Afrikaans churches. And there's so many South Africans who have their families overseas. When I went to Australia in 2018, I had a lady saying to me, "Are you coming to visit your children or your grandchildren?" I said, "No, all my children and grandchildren live in South Africa, in Cape Town, in my home." I said, "How did you get that right? And I've got 4 children, 3 grandchildren, all living in your home. How's that possible?" I said, "Well, we believe in the future of our country. We're investing in the future." And it's interesting, all the Liberals voted for PFP. We used to call the Progressive Federal Party the Pact for Perth Party. But sure enough, as soon as they got what they'd been fighting for, overthrow of the National Party government, abolition of apartheid, and bring in a black majority government under ANC, they fled to Australia. So the PFP were the Pact for Perth. But the hardcore racists stayed in South Africa to make it work. So the people who fled to California and to England and Canada and New Zealand and Australia, they were the Liberals. The people who stayed in South Africa to keep the lights on and to do the work and to actually care for the people, we are the racists. Does that make any sense to anyone? Now, the uproar in South Africa over the claims for the ANC that the 1913 Land Act dispossessed blacks is a blatant lie. It's one of the 4 core lies about South African history that drives this incessant genocide of hate speech and this kill the Boer, kill the farmer rhetoric that Malema epitomizes. And these are the kind of people epitomizing this over and over in their political speeches and their Facebook and Twitter postings. And then you get a Volksfreier, that's Afrikaans for people traitor, like Rolf Meyer. Rolf Meyer was the head of the National Party's negotiation team. He was Ramaphosa's opposite number. He and Ramaphosa basically had a bromance, a brother's romance, I think is the term they use. And he later joined the ANC, and then in the last couple of elections he's been voting ANC and helping to advertise the ANC. He was the National Party's general secretary who actually negotiated for all the excellent guarantees that we're all benefiting from today, right? When National Party was the most powerful force in the country, had been in government for 40-something years, was the most financially powerful political party, when they had all the power, controlled the military, the police, the economy, he negotiated the mess that we've got today. I met Rolf Meyer on behalf of Christian Action, and I was a junior member of the delegation. Ed Kane was the leader of our delegation. And as Dr. Ed Kane, a lovely old gentleman, was explaining the situation to him, Rolf Meyer just exploded and started shouting and screaming at Ed Kane, saying, "There's no threat from the left. The threat's from the right. It's from right-wing extremists like you." Well, Ed Kane was nothing close to an extremist. He was an academic man and a man of God. Well, I interrupted and said, "Mr. Meyer, there's no need to speak to Dr. Kane in that tone." And he turned around and said, "And I know all about you, Peter Hammond. I know all about you." And, well, I don't know what that means, but he was ranting and raving, "You're the enemy. You right-wingers." Well, we're evangelical Christians. So the people burning down the streets and murdering people, massacring Zulus, they weren't the problem. The ones attacking St. James Church, they weren't the problem. The problem in the 1990s was evangelical Christians like Christian Action, according to Rolf Meyer. Well, there's a common belief in South Africa that the Native Lands Act of 1913 shoved blacks onto reserves. You've heard this? Blacks were crammed into 7% of the land and prohibited them from buying land in white areas. I think you've noticed there's no blacks who've got any land in white areas. So they say. And this has been repeated over and over. The whites forcibly removed blacks to these reserves, and these reserves were the worst land in the country. No mineral riches. The whites kept all the best land, best minerals for themselves. That's the propaganda. Now, you might be tempted to believe that myth because it would ensure eternal victimhood status and compensation for generations to come. Victimhood is great. You get out of responsibility free. I'm not to blame. It's all my parents' fault, or it's all the teacher's fault, or it's the police's fault, someone else's fault, but it's not my fault. How nice to blame other races, other generations, for my lack of initiative or lack of energy or whatever it is. It's a blatant lie. It can be attributed to a lack of reading ability or legal comprehension of numerous journalists and historians of our time. For example, Julius Malema calls Elon Musk an illiterate. Now, Elon Musk is arguably one of the most intelligent people in the world today. I mean, running SpaceX and all that, he could hardly be unintelligent. He's made a lot of phenomenal advances and investments and inventions. I don't know what Malema's got to his name. I don't know if Malema's IQ goes much above room temperature, but Elon Musk is hardly an illiterate. First of all, the biggest platinum reserves in the world were in the former black homeland of Botswana, what's now Northwest Province. So South Africa had no problem letting Botswana, under the Tswana people, control the biggest platinum reserves in the world. Even though the Tswana had already been given the whole country, Botswana, by the British, and most of the Tswana living in Northwest Province were immigrants from Botswana who'd come in for migrant labour. But they were given a huge part of South Africa. In fact, Bechuana land, what we today call Botswana, used to be part of South Africa, administered by the British. And the British also gave two other massive countries independence, Lesotho and Swaziland. Interesting when people say the Cape of Good Hope should not have independence, because the British had no problem recognizing that Lesotho had the right to Lesotho, the Tswana had the right to Botswana, the Swazis had the right to Swaziland, and they redrew the map and let them go free from South Africa. So that gets rid of the 7%, because already a lot of the people in South Africa have already been given a huge amount of other lands, like Botswana, Swaziland, and Lesotho. Now, here's an actual rural development and land reform document. So, whites own, in the Eastern Cape, 3 million hectares. Free State, 3,700,000 hectares. Gauteng, 275,000 hectares. KZN, 853,000 hectares. The largest amount of land that whites own in terms of farms or anything else is in Northwest and Northern Cape. Northern Cape, 11,498,000 hectares. And Northwest Province, 2.4 million. Western Cape, 2.7 million. Now, bearing in mind, South Africa is 122 million hectares in total area. So the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform has officially confirmed that 26 million hectares are owned by white farmers. That is 22% of South Africa, not 93%. So the 7% lie is obviously the very foundation of saying that whites took the best land is false. Most of the land in the Western Cape, by the way, in Northern Cape, is arid, very low rainfall, desert, semi-desert. The toughest land to farm, the best land in the country, is KwaZulu-Natal in Eastern Cape, in terms of high rainfall, fertility, soil. Do you know that the Southern government is sitting on 4,323 farms that were handed over by the previous white owners but never transferred to black owners? So at the very time that they were calling for expropriation without compensation because they needed land, and Malema screaming, we need land. Well, I don't know how many black people in South Africa want to be farmers. I don't know how many white people in South Africa want to be farmers. Farmers' work starts early in the morning, and it's hard work. It's hard physical work. I don't think many of us want to be farmers. To be honest, there's a certain romance about farming, but the reality is you get up early and you work hard in the sun, and it's not actually that easy. It's by the sweat of your brow, and there's a lot of thorns and all the rest of it. Not to mention genocidal maniacs who want to kill you. Well, here's another lie. Lie number two. Black homelands were the worst land in South Africa. When you compare the rainfall map of South Africa, anyone with elementary knowledge of South Africa will tell you the largest part of South Africa is called the Karoo. Yellow Cape. And so this is the Karoo behind that yellow line. Arid, very, very low rainfall. You get Central Karoo, Klein Karoo, and of course there's also Otanikwa land, which is quite nice rainfall because that's part of the Gold Rush. But the Klein Karoo and the Central Karoo, where most of the farms are found, are extremely arid. You would not want to eke out an existence there. Without a borehole, you will not survive, and there's very little rainfall there. It's a semi-desert, comparable to Nevada or Arizona in America. Blacks never entered this area. They never settled it. Whites made it blossom, created successful sheep farms producing meat of world quality. And the symbol is these windmill boreholes, because you couldn't survive without them. And the whites have dominated farming in these very unattractive farming areas where you need thousands of hectares to be able to even keep a decent flock of sheep. It's not something that you could do much on a small area. You need a large area to manage. The black settlements were found to the north and the east coast of South Africa. The east coast has a subtropical climate, the north a prairie-like climate with some rainfall and thunderstorms. The exception to all this weather is the Western Cape, where we live. We have a Mediterranean climate and a winter rainfall, dry summers, wet winters. The northern and eastern parts of South Africa, with its beautiful green grasslands, fertile soil, is where blacks eventually coalesced, and this is the land they chose for themselves. The greenest parts of South Africa is where the black homelands were situated, where most of their settlements are. The eventual homelands were found in the land they inhabited out of their own free will. And you can see from these lights where the bulk of the population live, this is what it looks like at night with a satellite picture showing the distribution of electricity. So you get a bit of an idea of where the majority of people in the country choose to live. There's not many people living in the Karoo. It's pretty dark there. And then you get the Cape Peninsula. When you look here at the Cape Peninsula, a lot of it's rocky, arid. The Afrikaners even have a song praising the greenness of Natal. Groen is die land van Natal. Green is the land of Natal. It was a perfect grazing area for the cattle herding Bantu Nguni people like the Zulu. Now here's line number three. Blacks are indigenous to South Africa, they first settled it. Today, blacks in South Africa often tell Afrikaners and other minorities like coloureds, Malays, Indians, Chinese to adapt to the misrule and corruption or go home, like our home is somewhere else. Implying that we who've been born here, I was born in Cape Town, most people in Cape Town were not born in Cape Town. I'm actually one of the minority of Cape Townians who can say I was born in Cape Town. As can all my children say. And we hold legal citizenship through successive birthrights, but we should immigrate to Europe, Malaysia, India or elsewhere if we don't belong in the land of our birth. That's what they're saying. The only ones who have a legal claim to South Africa out of it all are the blacks. Blacks believe that they're indigenous to South Africa, but they're not. This has been proven by DNA research. We're not. We're actually all settlers in South Africa. Everyone came here at some stage. Nobody was here in perpetuity in the sense of any race or tribe. All South Africans are settlers regardless of their skin colour, and their DNA carries the proof. This is the verdict of Dr. Wilmot James, the head of the African Genome Project. He's a distinguished academic, a sociologist, and more recently, the honorary professor of human genetics at the University of Cape Town. Where is the archaeological proof that blacks actually settled in South Africa? Apart from a few scattered archaeological remains found of black culture in the far northern Transvaal prior to 1652, it's generally agreed that blacks and whites were both contemporary settlers of South Africa. We use the term settler loosely because blacks never actually settled South Africa. Their presence was nomadic. Blacks were itinerant to travel from place to place with no fixed home. Whole capitals of cities of grass huts like Kwa Bulawayo or Dingaanstad Ongungungungungu could be relocated if the grazing was exhausted. And when a Zulu king died, his capital was burned. A new capital was established. They all had to move. They had no demarcated areas, no fences, no borders, no maps, no title deeds to prove ownership of any land apart from a verbal claim and mutual understanding that their temporary presence in a certain area in a certain period of time constituted ownership of the land. They left behind no foundations of buildings, no statues, no roads, no rock paintings, not a single proof of settlement on the land prior to the white settlers in South Africa. The only rock paintings were made by the Bushmen and the Hottentots, or the Khoisan and San, in the caves they temporarily occupied. By the way, interesting about that, the Khoisan have left rock paintings all over East Africa, all the way down Central and Southern Africa. And no Khoisan live there anymore. And the fact is, historically, the Khoisan, and I was at a meeting of Khoisan kings recently, the Khoisan were exterminated by the Nguni or Bantu tribes as they moved south from Ethiopia. And they hunted them and wiped them out, even hunted them for sport. The only Khoisan that survive anywhere in Africa today are in the areas where the whites came and provided them with protection, in the Western Cape and in Southwest Africa, what is today Namibia. They got exterminated everywhere else. And you can see the rock painting showing they used to be there, but no more. And that's why in the seven frontier wars between the settlers in the Cape and the Khoisan in the Eastern Cape, or Transkei, the Khoisan always were on the side of the whites. They joined the Dutch and later the British and fought with them against their eternal enemies, the Khoisan, interestingly. So blacks were pastoral nomads, meaning they had cattle and goats, and the Bushmen, the Hottentots or Khoisan, were hunter-gatherer nomads. They lived off the land by hunting wild animals. Now here's some photographs from early settlers and missionaries of how the people were living in, for example, Matabele land. And get some pictures of some of the tribes like the Zulu. These are all late 1800s pictures. And you get a bit of an idea of the states, because according to Malema, the whites came and stole the land, stole their technology, took them and impoverished them. But you don't get the impression that these people were living very enriched lives before the missionaries or the evil colonials arrived and brought things like railways, bridges, hospitals, medicines, advanced agriculture, and so on. Now these people must have been converts to Christianity because they're actually wearing clothes, and there wasn't much wearing of clothes before the missionaries made an impact. And you can see interesting types of hairstyles which are probably coming back now. And in fact today you can see people in San Francisco looking like this, nose piercings and plates going into extended lips is probably a new development they're going to get you just now. So white settlers, on the other hand, built cities and railroads and dams and first world countries comparable to the best in Europe, in the New World, and their legacy speaks of people intended to live here for 1,000 years or more. Interesting, the Boers never ripped down Queen Victoria's statue after the Afrikaans people took control of the country in 1910 and later, and especially under James Barry Hertzog and others, and yet under her reign, in her name, the concentration camps and the genocide of the Boers had been raged. So, intriguing that they still respected the statues of foreign monarchs under whom war was waged against them, and in very close memory, and this even in the confines of the Cape Parliament. And I think we can see the development of advanced civilizations in Cape Town. And this is Peter Maritzburg, which some people called the last outpost of the British Empire. Is this a railway station? I think it's a railway station, PMB. And so many estates. Johannesburg at one time was called the largest man-made forest in the world. Large amounts of forest that was actually planted by the urban settlers. So that they had an 800% increase in birds living in the Gauteng area after the settlers came, because there was so much more water, so many more trees, and species migrate from Mozambique even to Johannesburg area because it was so attractive. And in Pretoria, the old Raadsaal of the Transvaal Republic, and Oom Powell, Monument and Church Street. They've renamed Church Street, I believe, because it's offensive to have a church named Church Street. And where is this now? Anyone remember? It could be Bloemfontein. I'm just puzzled for a moment.
Sorry. All those Jacobins.
All those Jacobins. Sorry? Okay, thank you. I just don't recall that. I mean, okay, now of course Union Buildings, one of the most magnificent government headquarters anywhere in the world. I remember going to Union Buildings on a date. In fact, I kind of knew every date that cost no money because I was such a penniless missionary. And I remember taking dates from Pretoria University up to Union Buildings at night, and we'd lie there in the beautiful botanical garden looking up at the stars, and it was magnificent seeing the lights of Pretoria. It was perfectly safe. Not only couldn't you do it today, you'd be kind of insane if you tried because of the crime, but also they fenced off Union Buildings, so the citizens aren't allowed to access the buildings or even the botanical gardens that once were freely accessible. That's what freedom is. You suddenly don't get access to what you used to have access to. And just have a look at this view of... This is Pretoria, isn't it? I think so. All these jacaranda trees. Just so Pretoria used to be a beautiful place, and people used to enjoy living in Pretoria. I don't know that they would say the same about Tshwane today. And the botanical gardens and Union Buildings, absolutely magnificent. Love going to the botanical gardens. Said it made a nice, cheap date. You could go to a place like that and it didn't cost you anything, and you could be in beautiful environments. And that's why I liked going on hikes. I would always take my dates on hikes up the mountain because you could do it for free. Never had money to spare. That's part of white privilege, you see. My white privilege was we got caned at school, got conscripted to the army, got beaten up by the NCOs. First things that the sergeant major said to us was, "You don't do what I tell you, I'm going to rip your arm off and beat you to death with a sticky end." And all that sort of thing. And I won't give all of it because a lot of it's unpronounceable and quite nasty, and they were really brutal to us. But we got trained. That was our white privilege, getting shouted at, screamed at, kicked and beaten, and given rock PT at an army. Then they put you up in the area where people threw metal at you and want to kill you, while we were protecting black people like the Avambos from red communists who were kidnapping them and so on. And then, my war white privilege for me was working my way through full-time at college to get to college because I was too male and pale to get any bursary at Baptist Theological Seminary, and the black and coloured students had their education free. I worked 6 days a week, 8 hours a night, the fire brigade, to put myself through college, and I paid taxes so that the people who were called the previously disadvantaged got things for free, the things I had to pay for. And interestingly, I speak about the previously advantaged and the previously disadvantaged. As far as I can see, I was previously disadvantaged and I'm presently disadvantaged. It's always been a disadvantage to be white in South Africa, even in apartheid South Africa. And as far as I know, Malema, who never lived under apartheid, doesn't know what he's talking about. He was always advantaged. He could get free everything that the rest of us would have to work and pay for. And he could lie, steal, cheat, and loot and get away with it. So there's far more privilege for the Malema types. But anyway, I digress. To claim that the whole of Africa belongs to blacks is absurd. It's like an Italian claim that the whole of Europe belongs to Italians, which of course the Romans did try to push, including Norway. In fact, the pyramids of Egypt are proof of white settlement going back thousands of years. You just look at the Sphinx, which is the body of a lion, but the face of a pharaoh. And even despite some Muslim shooting cannon at the nose to try and deface this monument, you can still see the features are definitely European-type features on the Sphinx. And the Phoenicians settled Carthage, and the Greeks settled Alexandria. So there were white civilization north of Africa, as you can see from the cities they built, in this case Alexandria and Carthage, and tremendous advances Alexandria. And you can see from the civilizations built in northern Africa. North Africa was a place of white African civilization, such as Carthage, Hannibal, and the Carthaginians, who gave the Romans some real grief. The Arabs settled North Africa later, colonizers, mind you, and after Prophet Muhammad died, just as the whites were settling Southern Africa from 1652 onwards. So there were three Africas, as Dr. Ishel really called it in his book, The Third Africa. Arabic Africa up north, which supplanted the old European civilizations of northern Africa, Black Africa in the center, and White Africa in the south, which at that stage included Southwest Africa, Rhodesia, and to a degree Portuguese East and West Africa as well. And so, if you think of the biblical divisions between the people of Japheth and Shem and Ham, the three main, the three sons of Noah, you have the three main racial divisions of the world. And Africa comes from the Hamites, as the people in Asia come from Shemites, and those in Europe more from Japheth, looking at the three sons of Noah as the breakdown. And when it comes to Egypt, the greatest power in the ancient world, everything revolved around the Nile. The Nile is what provided all life, and you can see a lot of the monuments along the side there to see the different civilizations in northern Africa. They were able to be harvesting grain, wheat, and grapes in North Africa back in the Roman Empire. Amazing what Islam did for North Africa. They turned what was productive wheat farms into Sahara Desert. And then you can see how different African tribes migrated, either from Ethiopia in the hinterland or from Nigeria. And there were some intriguing old civilizations like Great Zimbabwe or Zimbabwe Ruins in what used to be Monomotapa. And there's other fascinating civilizations all over Africa, from Congo, Aksum, Nubia, the Lozi, the Lunda, people we've all worked amongst in our missionary work, and Monomotapa in what today is Zimbabwe. Plus, of course, the kingdom of the Zulu and the Xhosa, which were most dominant in southern Africa. So there's a lot of African kingdoms and empires showing there was movement, there was migration, just as there was of European nations and tribes. Tremendous changes amongst the tribal mixture of Europe and the British Isles, Saxons, Angles, Jutes, Celts, and so on. And, of course, Britain used to have their painted savages running around as well, going into battle, wearing nothing but body paint, and that was part of their old culture. And there were some very savage tribes amongst the Germanic Saxons, and the Vikings were incredibly savage. But in time, the gospel tamed even the Vikings and the Celts and the Saxons. And so Africa has a fascinating history, which unfortunately I think many Marxists like Malema have no understanding of. It would be very helpful for them to understand the different tribes and the different history and developments and cultures of Africa and how it came to be as it is today. And I've got whole courses and a manual on a Christian history of Africa, which I've just taught up at Back to the Bible College, which is very useful to understand how Africa came to be what it is now, and many of the great and rich cultural traditions in its past, especially the Christian kingdoms of Nubia and Tawa and Alwa and Ethiopia. But this is now of Luangwa in what today is Angola, and there's copper and gold being mined in what many people thought was the King Solomon's mines, which is in present-day Zimbabwe. And then the classic African civilizations before the Asiatic invasions of the north by the Arabs and the European invasions from the south, to use their terms, the kingdoms of Kush and Put and of Twa and Luba, Bemba, and of the San and the Nguni, out of which the Zulu and the Xhosa came. The San surviving in this area because they came under the protection of the Boers or the Dutch. Not that the geographers knew much about Central Africa before David Livingstone. Most of the scientists believed that the center of Africa was mostly desert, which of course David Livingstone proved them wrong. And again, it's a lot more complex than what these simpletons in the expropriation of compensation. Africa belongs to Africans. There shouldn't be any white Arabs, colored or Indians in Africa people. They don't seem to understand the history. If you can say that, does that mean there should never be any blacks allowed in Europe or America, by that logic? And this is population density, where most of the people live in terms of population. You can see around the Great Lakes, there's very high population density because there's a lot of water there, a lot of rainfall, huge amount of rainfall also in Ethiopia. Nigeria also has a large amount of rainfall, so they can afford to have a large amount of population. And we've got most of our population is close to the southeast coast, where, of course, dense rainfall, and from the Drakensberg or Dragon Mountains, a lot of rainfall coming down, providing some of the best agricultural potential. Now, the white settlers at the Cape first came face to face with Bantu around 1770 on the banks of the Great Fish River, just before the French Revolution. Whites start to meet blacks in South Africa, in the Cape, on what today would be the clash between the Fish River, between what was the Eastern Cape and what was then the Transkei. 120 years after Jan van Riebeeck came to the Cape, and 1,000 kilometres east of Cape Town, whites and blacks first faced one another on the banks of the Fish River. Now, line number four is whites created black reserves and homelands. And this is part of what justifies the Julius Malema chance of kill a Boer, kill a farmer, is the whites created the black reserves and homelands and forced the blacks into a small and impoverished area. The truth is, black people themselves created the homelands thanks to Shaka Zulu. The common belief is that the black tribes at the time were all living peacefully in the spirit of Ubuntu, which is the term which basically is interpreted to be humanism. My Zulu friends say, when people speak of Ubuntu, it's the same as what we mean when we say humanism in English. So today the liberals will say the blacks are living in peace and under Ubuntu, with each person in a virtual liberal paradise. No violence or anything like that. So you mustn't study the history and discover how Shaka really was with Lords and Mifikon. You don't want to know that, because everything was good, it's just the gospel that ruined everything when the missionaries came. Nothing could be further from the truth. Shaka Zulu was a genocidal ruler, a great man for sure, but his policy was to wipe out multitudes of black people in the Difikon, the great crushing. Now, he was badly treated and bullied as a child, and he was outraged at how badly his mother was treated. So when he came to power, he decided to really punish the people who had made things miserable for his mother, and he created a very disciplined nation, forcing people to dance on thorns, and if they showed any pain, having them assegaied or knob carried to death. He had, when his mother died, he forced the people to mourn and to cry and weep for months. And when anyone stopped crying, they were killed. If anyone had a child during the time, both the people and the child were put to death, because no one was allowed to have any babies during the time of mourning. And the people died by the tens of thousands just during the mourning for his wife, for his mother. His mother, Nandi. And so Shaka Zulu had people wiped out by large numbers, largely because of the rage he felt over how he had been treated and how his mother had been treated as a child. Now, Zulu tyrant Shaka was committing genocide against other tribes, and when we say genocide, we mean genocide. He had them throw away their sandals, and they wouldn't throw away their spears, though. They would have some spears for throwing, but their main spear was more like a sword. It was what they called an assegai, a broad type of blade with a short stabbing handle. The idea was, you stab with the assegai, you don't throw your main weapon away. And so it was closer to a sword in the way we would think. And his men would go in, not for the old way of just taunting, singing, throwing your assegai, your spears, missing mostly, and then people running away. No, this was, you went in like the bull, the head to gore, and the encircling horns to encircle, and then wipe out everyone in between. And so his idea of war was not, we don't play at war, we go in to kill everyone on the other side. They'd amalgamate the women and children into the MPs and nation, but they would kill the military-aged men of the opposing side that they were fighting. And reading the washing of the spears, for example, will give you an idea of how this worked. Well, other than Nguni, the Swazis and the Ndebele's fled north in the direction of Central Africa, where they'd migrated from to escape from his anger. And the Sutus fled into the mountains of what today is Lesotho. The rest of the tribes huddled together to find some strength and coalescing. And the reason why you've got the tribes in the place they are right now is largely because the Mifikon, or the Difikon, the great crushing, or the genocidal wars, in which about 2 to 3 million black people died. And this, we're talking about, is between about 1819 and 1823. It's a very short space time, but vast amount of people killed, akin to like the First World War was to Europe, this was to Southern Africa. And at the end of it, there were few survivors hiding in mountains and different places, And that's why the Kwakwa, where the Kwakwa, while the Swazi are where the Swazis are, they fled to mountains where they could escape the impis of Shaka. And this is the way the British saw it, that they were coming in for civilization to help save the smaller tribes from the big Zulu impis who were wiping them out. Of course, that's a bit of a simplification propaganda too, but that's the way the British saw it at the time. That's part of the history of black South Africa that many would prefer to ignore. Black Zulus drove other blacks off their land, not the whites. It's into this maelstrom of chaos that the Boers tricked in 1838. They were following in the wake of the Mifokon. And not just the Mifokon of Shaka, but the Mifokon of Shaka's general, Mzilikazi. Mzilikazi had fled from the wrath of Shaka, and before he got his head knocked out by Nokiri, he took his tribe up into the north, into what today is the Transvaal, where they encountered the Boers and got beaten at the Battle of Gekko. And then they fled north into what today is Madibe land. Later became Rhodesia and became someone else's problem. And so here it just shows some of the problems of even when the cause to escape the Zulu were invading the Cape and getting turned back by the British and the Greek and so on. So this shows you that as far as they went, they found large open sections of the country uninhabited by anyone. When the Boers tricked into the land, they weren't taking land from anyone. They're going into land that's just mostly depopulated. The black tribes either wiped out, amalgamated into the belly of the Zulu, or had fled up the mountains to hide where they could protect themselves easily by just rolling rocks and assailants in Lesotho, on the Dragons Mountains, Drakensberg, or up at the Magaliesberg, or in Swaziland, Lebombo Mountains. And so the homelands, as set out by Hendrik Voigt, were actually determined more by Lubin Gulo, Mzilikazi, and Shaka than by anyone else. So black survivors fleeing Shaka's carnage grouped them together in areas near whites to secure protection. And that's why the first thing the Boers would find wherever they went is there'd be a black chief coming to them asking for their protection. And they would come under protection and there would be some kind of arrangements made to often protect these people. And this is how Sir Theophilus Shepson later found the remnants of black refugees huddled together on self-created reserves. He just demarcated it in order to protect them from one another. The tribal trust lands were not set up in order to deprive them. They weren't forced into there. They were already living there. And these homeland boundaries were drawn in order to protect them from exploitation, from white traders amongst others. The creators of the so-called Bantustans or homelands were not the Boers or the whites, not even the evil British Empire. It was black men like Shaka, Mzilikazi, and Dingaan. And you can read about this in Warrior Chiefs of Southern Africa, or we've got Path of Blood by Becker on the history of the Mabili. Some of these books on the shelves behind me which give you history. Now, just to show you some of the maps that have been produced by the EFF, where they are, these are some of their land claims maps, where they want to confiscate some of the best land in the country. The National Assembly of South African Governments sent shockwaves around the country by setting in motion a process to change the constitution so as to allow expropriation of land without compensation. And Cyril Ramaphosa in his opening speech emphasised without compensation. And this got the loudest applause of the evening. Now, what paved the way beforehand, which we all need to know about, to understand where Malema comes from and why Malema is shouting this genocidal killer Boer, killer farmer. Remember that Malema was the youth leader of the African National Congress. He was an ANC member. But in 2012, the year of the Freedom Charter and the Unity in Action to Advance Economic Freedom, the African National Congress had their General Assembly up in Pietersburg, if I remember right, and they launched what they called the second phase of the revolution. 2012. Remember the date. The threat to private ownership of property, the clearly stated intent to remove constitutional safeguards and protections for private ownership of property, staggered overseas observers. And they'd make statements like taking from whites is not a crime. Now, the second phase of the revolution, just to say a bit more about it, I've read the 70-page document. It's a cure for insomnia, actually. But nevertheless, there's important things in it. Basically, they're talking about we've got to go to the second phase of the revolution. Second phase of the revolution is taking control of everything. First phase of the revolution is political control. Second phase of the revolution is For example, the reign of terror after the French Revolution, that second phase of the revolution, when it took the churches and everything else. Or in Russia, when they had decolonization, taking the farms. Or in China, the great cultural revolution, where they sought to take over everything, including the farms. And in Zimbabwe, when they started the farm invasions in, after the year 2000. So the second phase of the revolution is to take control of everything. To have a successful second phase of the revolution, we go from political control to total control of everything, including the economy, requires a vanguard of the revolution. And a 70-page document, which was adopted at Petersburg at the 2012 ANC Congress, determined that they must have a vanguard of the revolution to lead this revolution, the second phase of the revolution. Well, hey presto, what happens after the 2012 conference? Malema leaves the ANC and starts the EFF. What happened this last weekend? The EFF celebrating the 10th anniversary. 10 years ago, Malema left the ANC and started the Economic Freedom Fighters, the EFF, which is now the third largest political party in the country, after the ANC and the DA. It is my thesis and belief that the EFF is not an enemy of the ANC, it's not a competition to the ANC, it's not a breakaway from the ANC, it is the ANC's vanguard of the revolution. I believe that Julius Malema is still serving the cause of the ANC in accordance with the 2012 second phase of the revolution agenda. And he provides plausible deniability for the ANC. You can say to people overseas, well, that's not us, that's just the EFF. And I think they're also having the idea that if the ANC gets less than 50%, it's not a problem because the EFF and the ANC can form a coalition. As they did when Ramaphosa came to power in 2018, what did he do? Made a speech about expropriation of compensation, and what's the first thing they did after that? They voted to accept Julius Malema's EFF proposal for expropriation of compensation. Now, if Julius Malema was a traitor, a deserter, a competition enemy, and if the EFF were Volksverein, if they were deserters of the ANC would not have voted for their program, but every ANC member parliament, without exception, voted for the EFF's expropriation of compensation bill in 2018. This proves that it was a fraud, what do we call it, a complete sham. This EFF pulling away from the ANC is about as fraudulent as the Sino-Soviet split. During the Cold War, there was a big thing made of Red China breaking with the Soviet Union. But evidence was made later that, in fact, it was a fraud in order to deceive people, a strategic deception, so that America would not be looking at our enemies, China and Russia, but that China can be an ally against the Soviet Union. Soviet Union can be an ally against China. And they would systematically take turns between building up China militarily or building up Russia. And then they could say they were doing something logical. But it was a strategic deception to divide the West. There was no Sino-Soviet split. I'm maintaining there is no genuine split between the ANC and the EFF. Now, the supporters on the ground may think so. I think there's genuine animosity between EFF and ANC supporters on the ground. But the leaders are working together, and I've got some photographs to prove this. Look at this. Julius Malema, Winnie Mandela, Cyril Ramaphosa. What does this body language show you? Are these people enemies? Is this a traitor and a competitor to the ANC, someone who's just pulled away a third of the ANC support base to join his rebellion? I don't know. It looks to me like these people are friends. It looks like they actually like one another. I don't know if you can fake this kind of body language. It looks to me like they genuinely are friends. So all ANC and EFF voters voted together for this expropriation of compensation theft by majority vote bill. Now, the African National Congress and Economic Freedom Fighters voted for expropriation of compensation. The DA, Freedom Front, Congress of the People, COPE, ACDP and others voted against it. So plainly, the ANC and the EFF were working in lockstep together. Total cooperation. The supportive profile of the EFF, what are the kind of people who are chanting, dressed in red and chanting in this stadium, kill a Boer, kill a farmer, bah, bah, shoot to kill? Well, most of them live in Mpumalanga, in Gauteng, I should say. And then some large concentration in Mpumalanga. You've got the Eastern Cape, of course, that's Transkei. Limpopo is their heartland in many ways. and Western Cape only 4%. The EFF is not a significant factor in the Western Cape, but they can make a lot of noise. Northern Cape 1%, Free State 1%. Interesting, they are stronger in metropolitan areas than cities and large towns, small towns, but still 51% are rural. EFF's 99% black, and I'm not too sure where they found those imbeciles to make 1% white, but there are white EFF people, and I'm not sure what white person would support a party that's committed to destroying and killing all white people. As part of the course for white genocide, white members must be very low down the gene pool. Now, EFF, a lot of them are living on government grants. You can see the breakdown of the languages they speak. A lot of them are Sepedi, or Pedis, as we know them, and of course, Khoisan and Zulu, high percentages. Working status. A whole 22% of the EFF actually are working full-time, 9% half-time, 20% are students, 2% are retired, housewives 2%, unemployed 40%, actually 45%. And then marital status, 74% single, married or living together 25%. It sort of gives you a bit of an idea. Also, men are 67%, women are 33%. So that's your profile of the EFF supporter, if that tells you much. Total monthly income, you can see where they stand on that as well. Now, the one-time ANC leader...
Sorry,
yes?
On that other slide, under education, what is that?
What are you thinking?
Oh. What type of education have they got?
You're talking about this?
Yeah.
No formal education, 2%. High school, 33%, yes. Technicon or third tertiary, 5%. Those who got grade 12 up to 48%. Some high school, 33%. There's a lot of them are still at school or haven't finished their schooling. University diploma, a whole 1%. And so the education is not of the highest. And remember, Julius Malema said that Elon Musk isn't illiterate. Elon Musk must be one of the most intelligent people in the world, but Julius doesn't think he can even... I don't know. His woodwork report might be as bad as mine was, which would be very bad. One time, ANC leader Lakota, now the leader of COPE, said the ANC's tactics were imbecilic, racist attacks. Now, that's not my word. That's what COPE's leader, Lakota, said. He used to be called Terry Lakota. And that Malema was just misleading our people for cheap popularity to win votes. The notion of a stolen land, Lakota said, is a false narrative. We call on the ANC to pronounce themselves unambiguously as to whether they now leave the historic policy and abandon the Freedom Charter in favour of racist rhetoric of the EFF and the PAC, which is a good thing to point out. And they pointed out, do you know that the southern government is sitting on thousands of farms that they've not made available to black owners? And as we pointed out earlier, in fact, the lie that the whites took all land and the blacks only got 7% land is just obviously false by this government's own Department of Rural Development's forms that they put out. They just assumed we couldn't read or couldn't do maths. So what we've got today is we've got a fat cat government overburdening a small basis of voters and taxpayers and forcing them to pull a cart full of dung filled with land reform, and offering a very, very thin, shriveled up carrot as incentive for pulling this along. The EFF leader, Julius Malema, said he wanted it white men hard. We are cutting the throat of whiteness, he said. So even Mozimani of the DA said the EFF is destructive in its racist policy, it is madness, it is insane. Considering the catastrophic consequences of communist land reform in neighbouring Zimbabwe and racist hate speech at Mugabe led, it seems inexplicable that the ANC government side would want to follow in the footsteps of failure, committing economic suicide. People around the world have seen Malema leading this kill the Boer, kill the farmer, shoot to kill a mandla and so on. Do you think they're going to want to come here on tourism? Do you think they're going to want to invest here? It's basically economic suicide. A London barrister said, You cannot have land expropriation without compensation. It is illegal under international law. It is contrary to a dozen treaties South Africa has signed and ratified. It's a principle enshrined in the South African domestic law. You cannot change the constitution to make it legal. Treaty law is superior law. It always applies. You cannot take away people's right to property. The Bible says in Isaiah 8:20, to the law and to the testimony, if they do not speak according to this word, it's because there's no light in them. People who do not speak in accordance with God's word have no light. When Patrice Lumumba violated the constitution and the laws of the Congo with nationalizations of private property, the result was carnage, civil war, total economic collapse, and the Congo has not recovered from it to this day. Nationalization of industries and farms in Zambia, Tanzania brought economic collapse to these countries, and vast amounts of Western foreign aid kept these countries somewhat afloat, but the vast majority of aid was stolen by the corruption of the government themselves. When Mozambique was granted independence by the Portuguese in 1975, Samora Machel Falima confiscated all private property, even private laundromats, completely destroyed what was once part of Britain's economy. All the doctors left, only had two medical doctors left in the country after the revolution. And this is what the Grand Hotel looked like in Barra shortly afterwards. This is what socialism can do for your country. Before independence, Mozambique exported food. After Falima's revolution, more than a million Mozambicans died of starvation. The country was torn apart by a terrible civil war, which I was involved in the early days of Frontline Fellowship. And the land just became like this, once good farms. At independence in Zimbabwe in 1980, Mozambique's Samora Machel and Tanzania's Julius Nyerere, to their credit, actually warned Samora Machel, warned Robert Mugabe, do not make the same mistakes we made. They urged them, respect private property rights, let the Europeans continue to contribute to the economy. Mugabe here, and Nyerere, Samora Machel, Kenneth Gonda, Sam and Jomo. When Mugabe began threatening white farmers, most media comment was, there shouldn't be any concern because Mugabe was an intelligent person. He knew what dispossessing the farmers would be. It would be a catastrophe for the country. So it's not possible. Mugabe's an intelligent person. He wouldn't let this happen. We heard the same about Ramaphosa. But Mugabe did destroy Zimbabwe. And I've got evidence right here. I've got a $100 trillion note, $50 billion notes and others from Zimbabwe. And I've got real money here, one Rhodesian dollar, which is worth more than all of those. So Mugabe destroyed over 4,000 white farms, murdered farmers, destroyed what was the greatest agricultural economy in Africa, destroyed the main employer of Zimbabweans, the main provider of foreign aid and food, foreign exchange, I should say. And there's books out on Zimbabwe's failed land reforms. We should be learning about it in South Africa, considering Malema's trying to take us back to it. Yet, ZANU-PF of Mugabe did seize over 5,400 commercial farms, evicted the white farmers, and in many cases, these farms were third or fourth generation farmers. They had literally carved the farms out of wilderness, and they were able to take these flourishing farms and turn them into wastelands, which is quite an achievement. Zimbabwe's economy collapsed. More than half the total population fled, voted with their feet, voted no conscience and marked Zimbabwe. Do you know any country where more than half the population has left, aside from Zimbabwe? But most African leaders, including South Africa's, applauded and cheered Mugabe, and Julius Malema said Robert Mugabe is his hero and his example. And we should, South Africa should follow Zimbabwe's example. South Africa's ANC president, Thabo Mbeki, in my opinion, is the worst president South Africa ever had. I think that Ramaphosa might be the second worst. I think Zuma was the least worst of the ANC presidents. I think they're all bad. But Thabo Mbeki was the most Marxist doctrinaire, and he was trying to close all Christian schools, all Christian radio stations, trying to take away all guns from anyone who wasn't government. We had to fight him tooth and nail in everyone. The amount of marches to Parliament I did during Thabo Mbeki's time, and I did this imprecatory prayer proclamation. I got 100 leaders in the city to sign, which we delivered to his office a few months before he was kicked out of the ANC itself. And we had threatened and warned that we were going to pray for him to be removed from office if he did not do the right thing and bring in legislation to protect pre-born babies from the violence and injustice of abortion and to reverse his pornography, perversion policies and all these other things. And God heard those prayers, and Thabo Mbeki was kicked out, and he was considered unassailable at the time. But God removed him. We should pray against evil governments more often. And of course, the land reform deception continues to fuel Malema's whole campaign. So what's behind Malema's killer boer, killer farmer? It's part of the program of the World Economic Forum. It's a war on food, it's a war on fuel, it's a war on farmers. And the goal is depopulation, to bring the world's population from 8 billion down to 500 million. And they're quite open. The Rio Summit, the Earth Summit, the Agenda 21, they want to destroy farms, they want to destroy cities, they want to bring people into urban, rural, urban control centres. No more private, independent farms. Nobody having the ability to control their own food. We're all dependent on the state for everything, and where people can be controlled in a sort of Hunger Games type situation where the government controls everything, starve most of the people to death, because we've got too many people in the world, we're going to bring it down. And that's why the waging war against farmers in the Netherlands, the second largest exporters of agriculture in the world, immediately after America, €100 billion a year project. And the South African farmers also were producing so much food, the idea is to get rid of the South African farmers. What Julius Malema is a tool for the World Economic Forum. This is not insanity, this is not stupidity, it's part of an evil plan, part of a Sabbatean Illuminati plan. And so this, it is racism, and it is apparently an insanity in our eyes, but suiting the aim of depopulation and of the globalist totalitarian agenda. It's been tried in Zimbabwe, and it was so successful from their perspective, destroyed the country, brought the population way down. Population is less than half that it was at the beginning. And many people have died of starvation. Zimbabwe is a success story for the World Economic Forum. It was Kissinger who said recently that the biggest need for Africa is to reduce the population dramatically. And white South Africans and the old South Africa were feeding 100 million people in Africa. When our population was 25 million, the 70,000 white commercial farmers in South Africa were feeding 100 million people, four times the population of South Africa. Today we have only 28,000 farmers left, commercial farmers in South Africa. And they're feeding 40 million people, which is also a phenomenal achievement. But our population has doubled from the 25 million in 1994 to 60 million today. So it means we need to start importing food as well. We can't feed ourselves. South Africa is no longer food sufficient. And so the World Economic Forum's achieved a lot already. But Julius Malema can help them to achieve even more. And just think of the future if they follow their racist hate speech. There's no farmer, no food. And yes, who's going to suffer when you get rid of the white farmers? He says, kill the boer, kill the farmer. Who's going to suffer? Who's going to starve? Yeah, well, he doesn't care about his own people, apparently. But don't worry, some will get charity from the World Economic Forum's friends in the United Nations, World Food Programme, and others will come in and generously hand out a little bit of aid that they can get people to relocate and to position them and control them.
Genetically modified food.
Well, genetically modified food, yes, so you can't take the seeds and use it to plant for more. And just think of the potential benefits in the future to the policies of Julius Malema, this racist, genocidal hate speech. Well, the fall of Zuma and the rise to power of Cyril Ramaphosa was accompanied by waves of euphoria. Many Christians that I know are saying, we are saved, a new day is dawning. Now we can begin to rebuild our country. Our prayers have been answered. That's literally the way people acted with Ramaphosa. Ramaphosa is probably the second worst president in South African history. Jacob Zuma was much better than Ramaphosa. Under Zuma, at least our economy was growing. Not much, but just growing. Under Ramaphosa, it's been in a negative every single year. With his opening 2018 State of Nation address, Ramaphosa said, we will seize land without compensation, and he emphasized without compensation. And this is greeted with the loudest, most sustained applause of the address, like standing ovation. This just shows the mentality of the EFF and the ANC working in concert together, that actually the EFF is a deception operation of the ANC. It's a strategic deception. Considering that South Africans provide sanctuary to more than 10 million refugees, many of them from Zimbabwe, who fled endemic misrule to the north, imploding the food security of South Africa will affect far more than our own population. It'll starve our neighbours too. But don't worry, our government's on top of it, and in Parliament you can see these people are not sleeping on the job. In 1990, when Mandela became president, 70,000 white commercial farmers fed 100 million people throughout Africa. Today, 28,000 farmers are feeding 40 million. But the problem is we've got 60 million. And so, again, you can see the problems that we're facing. Even as the population of the country has doubled since 1994, our food production is less than 40% what was in 1994. And by the way, we're producing less electricity now than Eskom was in 1994. And it's cost 10 times more than it cost then too, by the way. And we never used to have power failures. The food crisis in Africa is about to get much worse, and so is the refugee crisis. The ANC government's been a failure on every level, especially economically. In 1984, the rand was closer to 2 rand to the dollar. Today it's around 15 rand to the dollar. Am I out of date? It's more like 18 rand to the dollar? More like 18 rand to the dollar now. And so, I remember my first mission to Transvaal. I left my motorbike in Cape Town. It cost me 32 rand petrol to get from Cape Town to Johannesburg. 32 rand, and I still, I think, had a full tank at the end. Now, I don't know what you could do for that. We used to be able to fill our tank with 5 rand. A 5 rand note could fill a petrol tank. We used to have a 5 rand note. Now, a 100 rand note won't get your petrol out of the empty. It's still in the E. And a $100 trillion note couldn't buy a loaf of bread in 2008 in Zimbabwe. Not a loaf of bread. Wheelbarrows. Yep. Scenes from the next attraction. Unemployment in 1994 was under 3 million. Today unemployment is close to 30 million. So that means for every year the ANC has been in power, they've added another million unemployed to the ranks of the unemployed. We now have more people unemployed in South Africa than there were living in all of South Africa in 1994. Now just think about the achievement that is. Working age population. Now, how do you love this statistic? How's this for dishonesty? When is Free Party got 43%? What's this here? You've got the employed as 43%. You've got the 35% are discouraged work seekers. And then you've got economically inactive is green.
Probably freelancing. Yeah,
economically inactive, discouraged work seekers. Tell me, what is the discouraged work seeker? Are they employed or not employed? So they've got these new categories. Wouldn't you put discouraged work seekers and unemployed together? But to keep the number of unemployed lower, they separate out discouraged work seekers. That's a typical government doublespeak. Power failures, water restrictions, rampant crime, rape and murder have become daily realities for the long-suffering people of South Africa. To distract citizens from their disastrous failure and catastrophic corruption, lies and distortions and disinformation and fabrications and misleading articles, campaigns of guilt manipulation like the ones I've been speaking about earlier, have been manufactured to create a smokescreen to cover the rampant corruption and incompetence of the ANC. The reason why the ANC has failed is because of, well, now they can say it's the taxi strike, which I'd call taxi war, and sometimes they'll say it's because of drought, and of course generally when you get down to it, everything that's wrong, it's the fault of apartheid, that makes it convenient, or the colonials, or the whites. But the thing that helps you understand it all is when you peel back the ANC, what do you get? Southern Communist Party. The Southern Communist Party is the hidden hand that controls the ANC. The ANC, remember, is just a shell. The Southern Communist Party controls the ANC. All the presidents of South Africa since the ANC have come to power have all been senior members of the Southern Communist Party Politburo. And the EFF is blatantly Marxist-Leninist. When you get down to it, the ANC are not a nationalist party. They might be nationalists on the ground, but they are communists at the top. The top control of the ANC is always in the hands of the Southern Communist Party, which is a breach of our electoral law. You're not meant to have dual membership. To enable the looting of the country, whites have been demonized and made scapegoats for every problem. Even after 28 years of ANC misrule, nothing is accepted as their fault. And it's like, maybe when you're 18, your life's in a mess because of your parents. But at a certain point, you've got to say in your 20s, if there's anything wrong with my life, it's not my parents' fault anymore, it's my fault. Because Maybe your parents did this, that, and the other, or didn't do the other thing. But at a certain point, it's your fault if you stay that way. Maybe you're not to blame for how you are, but you are to blame if you stay that way. You can't continue to blame your parents 18, 19, 20 years after leaving home and so on. And do you know that Frederick Chiluba, president of Zambia, who once was in the same prison I was in Lusaka, he said at Zambia's 28 independence celebrations, he said, enough already. The British left 28 years ago. If there's something wrong in Zambia, it's our fault. Can't blame the British anymore. And that's maturity. That's saying, okay, guys, we've grown up. We're more than a 10-year-old EFF. We've got to take responsibility. But the ANC doesn't take responsibility. They have 28 years, and they can't say what Frederick Chiluba said. If there's anything wrong in this country, it's our fault. We've been charged for 28 years. But how intelligent is this? Whites are to blame. So that's very convenient. Nothing is my fault. It's actually the fault of another race. And it's a minority at that. And they haven't been in power for decades. But if there's something wrong, it's their fault. That's convenient. Irresponsible politicians have engaged in the most reckless rabble-rousing and hate-mongering, like what we saw at the beginning tonight, threatening to subvert the very fabric of society. How can you trust your neighbour when 90,000 can dance up and down this demonic chant, kill the Boer, kill the farmer, Amandla, shoot to kill, ba-ba, ba-ba-ba. And this has gone around the world. Elon Musk has drawn attention to it from around the world, and even Australian news is showing this. And so what we saw earlier today, this has changed the perception of people all over the world to what's going on in South Africa. There might be a little bit more sympathy for us in South Africa, maybe, but there's not going to be much more investment, that's for sure. I mean, who can trust a country like that? But how can you trust your neighbour if your neighbour is an EFF member and you might have taken part in that kind of chant? What does this do to good neighbourliness and love for your neighbour and trust in your fellow man, fellow South Africans? At the presidential inauguration in 1994, Nelson Mandela declared, never, 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 never again will any South African be discriminated against on the basis of their race. And there was a lot of cheers and a lot of applause. I think that's noble sentiment. Wouldn't it be nice if they actually tried to do that? But I know my children have been discriminated against because of their race. Sports team quotas and support and all sorts of things like that. Even when it comes to employment, sports team quotas. There's so many things where you find a lot of race discrimination. And this is immediately followed by affirmative action, black economic empowerment and racial quotas, which only succeed in chasing away investors, employers, entrepreneurs and tourists, increasing unemployment. So, personal story. When my daughter Andrea was born in 1991, my mother said, you've just had the last apartheid baby. They're about to change the apartheid, the race classification act. So I went through to Weinberg, birth certificate, and you know, the question is, race of father, race of mother, race of child. When I got the type version back, I saw the race wasn't in it. So I was just, you know, as somebody asked questions, I said, excuse me, I see you haven't put the race in here, but I was required to fill it in the form. They said, well, some people object to the race being put in. I said, well, I've got no problem the way God made any of us. She said, I'm sorry, if you want to have the race of your child mentioned in a birth certificate, you need permission from the Minister of Home Affairs. I said, but why would I need permission to obey the law? How can the Minister of Home Affairs ignore the law? Because right now they're about to table the motion, but they haven't even voted on it yet. This is still the law, Race Classification Act. Interestingly enough, when my wife went to the American Embassy, they had 16 categories of racial category that she had to fill in. So the race classification of children was on the American birth certificate, but not on the South African birth certificate. My daughter, born 1993, also no race mentioned at all. When my son was born free, 1995 and 1999, race is back in it. So Mandela brought race classification back. So my son's birth certificate mentioned their race. My daughter's birth certificate does not mention their race. So my daughter was born under apartheid, their race is not mentioned. My children are born free when race was banned and their race classification is mentioned and affects whether they get education opportunities, bursaries or whatever. So that's just an example. Sorry, no donations to whites allowed. This has been so, remember during the lockdown lunacy? All this solidarity fund, it only went to black businesses if you were affiliated with ANC or EFF, that is. They even forbade Freedom Front from, or Afro Forum, from distributing private charity to whites who were starving and in need. Charity was not allowed to go to whites, it was only allowed to go to black people. But white people were starving and jobless, and yet AfriForum, not using government money but private donations, were told that we're not allowed to distribute charity. They had to give it to the government would distribute it. Yes, no, how that would work out. How can you trust your neighbours when some of them are dancing and cheering slogans like kill the Boer, kill the farmer? These people are hell-bent on destroying the country. Instead of redressing their failed policies, the ANC have continued to throw good money after bad, hell-bent on promoting immoral, unwise, counterproductive policies on every level. And you just think of the decolonization as part of the second phase of the revolution in the Soviet Union, which Joseph Stalin brought in, which brought in starvation of millions in Ukraine, which was depicted well in Animal Farm by George Orwell. Well, that's the second phase of the revolution. Lenin did the first phase of the revolution, Stalin did the second phase of the revolution, which included burning forests and farms, confiscating grain stores that were hidden from people who for some reason didn't like the idea of the NKVD confiscating the grain stocks and preventing them from having food in the coming winter. And literally people were dying on the streets of Kiev, capital of Ukraine, dying of starvation because the government had stolen all the food and confiscated their farms. This has happened in Ukraine before. People are all concerned about what's going on in Ukraine now, but what about what the West did to Ukraine by betraying it in the hands of the Soviet Union in the Versailles Treaty of 1919? Huge amounts of massacres of Ukrainians under Joseph Stalin, who was the Allies' friend, the ally, Uncle Joe, that Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Winston Churchill spoke to. And these are some of the poor Ukrainians back in 1930s as a result of the second phase of the revolution there. They say 6 million perished in the Soviet famine. That's early stats. 11 million more, current agreement. And there's an excellent film that depicts this, Bitter Harvest. It's in our library, well worth seeing. Bitter Harvest, produced by Canadians recently, Russian Ukrainians who fled to Canada, and they produced a very well-made film, Bitter Harvest. And it's positive. It's got resistance. It's not just showing the evil things done by the Soviets, but the strong Christian faith and resistance of the people. And so it's actually a mostly uplifting film. And very good people in it, like Max Irons, which was, and Terence Stamp, well worth seeing Bitter Harvest. And people who care about Ukraine now didn't seem to care about Ukraine when it was the communist Soviets murdering them. And the Holocaust in London 1994 is also relevant because I was in Kelvin Grove just down the road in 1999 during the 1999 run-up to elections, and there was every kind of political party present, and they were saying why you should vote to their parties, and the ANC person stood up and he was very arrogant. He said, when Nelson Mandela dies, we're going to kill all you whites like flies. Now it's a mostly white audience, Kelvin Grove, and here's this ANC person speaking like this, and I said, you mean like the Hutu murdered the Tutsi in Rwanda? And he said, yes, just like Rwanda. I said, did you notice how that turned out? And he stopped for a moment, and he was obviously confused. I said, the Hutu did manage to kill 800,000 Tutsi minority, who were mostly Protestants, but did you notice what happened afterwards? And he still didn't respond. So I said, David defeated Goliath. The minority took the country. The Hutu mass murderers were pushed into exile and fled into the Congo, where they are to this day. And today, Rwanda is in the hands of the Tutsi minority that the Hutu attempted to wipe out. He said the Tutsi were not known for their military heritage. They didn't have a heritage of great military skills. But the Afrikaans Boer, who you are saying you're going to annihilate, have a tremendous heritage going back centuries of martial skill and war experience. What do you think is going to happen if you try to genocide whites in South Africa?
You see what happened when they're trying to attack Brackenfell.
Well, actually, I don't think I know what happened there.
Well, they tried to invade a school in Brackenfell, and
the parents were turned off.
Totally smashed them.
Was this EFF?
EFF, yeah.
Oh. Well, this is what happened in Rwanda. Is fascinating because the Hutu mass murderers were overwhelmed when they were when they were able to be killing Tutsi. That was fine, but the moment the Tutsi fought back, they fled. even though they were armed and trained by the French and by the Libyans, the army of the MRND government, the majority, they fled into neighboring Congo, and the French had to send in a foreign legion to rescue them, create Operation Turquoise, put a buffer zone, and help withdraw the mass murderers into the Congo so that they could escape justice at the hands of the Tutsi victims. And the Tutsi, who had been refugees in Uganda, were able to get armed and come across the border, and they were so furious at what was being done, murdering their people. And they were surprised at the victory. Everywhere they went, the Hutu refused to fight. The Hutu had been moving defenseless, disarmed civilians by the thousands, couldn't stand and fight against a few refugees who were armed and ready to fight, and they fled. And so, I mean, this is the Kigali Parliament. As you can see, it's bullets, not ballots, to change government here. And I document all this in the Holocaust Rwanda, and it's a warning to the EFF. The Tutsi were not particularly militarily trained, didn't have a heritage of military, and yet even they managed to beat. When you put people where they've got nothing to lose, what do you think is going to happen? If they try to wipe out the whites in South Africa, whites at the moment are, how many South African whites do you think are working overseas in military contracts as advisors and mercenaries and so on across the Middle East and so on? And how many friends do they have? In fact, I've been in Australia and had people say to me, if it comes down to genocide in South Africa, I'll be there and come, you know, people who are in the Australian army, I'll come over and help you. And there are people all over the world with that attitude, just like when Rhodesia had its back to the wall. There are people from Canada, Britain, America coming over, Australia, New Zealand, coming over to fight for Rhodesia. There are South Africans all over the world who would come back here in a heartbeat. If there was a genocidal targeting of whites here, the ANC wouldn't know what hit them. There would be such a backlash, and I don't think they have any understanding. So when I reported some of this to this man at Kelvin Grove and sat back, he did look a bit shaken. He sat down after one. He didn't carry on with his boasting because, yes, he has to go and check his history. Genocide didn't turn out too well for the mass murdering thugs in Rwanda.
And the Tutsis are only 10% of the population.
Only 10%, yeah.
And they took it back. And
they still took it back, and they still got it. And nobody's questioning the fact that the minority are running Rwanda now, because the Hutus disgraced themselves. They have no moral right to run the country now because of their genocidal record. So this would not work out well for them if they tried that. So Rwanda is a warning. And so these people, like Julius Malema shouting out, kill the Boer, kill the farmer, they are dehumanizing the farmers and the whites. But they did this in Rwanda. They called the Rwandese Tutsis Inyenzis, which is the word for cockroach. And so, you know, you must clear the field of the cockroaches, get rid of the cockroaches. And that was the terminology they used. And in shooting dogs, which is one of the better films made of the Rwandan genocide, Hotel Rwanda's the Hollywood film made in South Africa with all South African American cast. Not a single Rwandese in it. No scene in Rwanda. And this is a soft expose. The real expose, Shooting Dogs, or Beyond the Gate, a British film based on the true story of what happened in the ETO school, and I've been there too, where the UN abandoned refugees who were under their protection, secretly, didn't tell them they were going to abandon them, waited for them to have lunch, and while they were having a meal, they drove out the gates, and the entire mass murderers were there beyond the gates, blowing the whistles with the machetes. They rushed through the gates and they murdered everyone who had been UN protection just a few minutes before. Shake Hands with the Devil is a book and film produced by General Romeo Dallaire, the Canadian general in charge of the United Nations forces in Rwanda. And the thing is, these are important case studies. So this is what happens when you dehumanize people and you make them the scapegoats and you whip up people in race hatred and you inspire people to genocide. Kill the Boer, kill the farmer, kill the Tutsi, kill the Inyenzis, clear the field of the Inyenzis, get rid of these Hamitic invaders, throw them in the river, send them back to Ethiopia, all that sort of stuff. And this film was made in Rwanda with all Rwandese cast, and General Romeo Dallaire was there on site to ensure the accuracy of the film from his perspective. And it's this telling because this man believed in the UN. He actually believed the UN was there to help. You think of the catastrophic land reform policies of Zimbabwe and where race hatred in Zimbabwe has taken that country, the worst inflation in the history of the world, the worst economic and agricultural disaster in African history, and to think the ANC wants to remove constitutional protections on private ownership property. It didn't turn out well for Zimbabwe, it will not turn out well for South Africa if they attempt it. Just to remind you, this is what happens to these once productive farms if you have land reform invasions, if you take away private ownership property. And so, this man, in front of police, had a bottle broken over his face, and that's blood, by the way, not tomatoes. And he said to police, "Are you not here to protect the citizens?" And the police said, "No, this is downtown Harare, capital city, in the main street, Zamora Michelle Avenue. Our job is to protect the policies of the government." So the police are not there to protect citizens, they're there to protect the government's policies. And so farmers in Zimbabwe were attacked for no other reason than that they were the wrong race. This is where killer boer, killer farmer gets you. This is what happened in Zimbabwe. And this brave man, Martin Olds in Bulawayo, 38 years old at this time, his poor wife had polio, she fled to Bulawayo. He said, sent her to Bulawayo because he heard they were going to attack. He stayed at the farm. He came outside and got shot in the leg. He crawled inside, got his rifle and pistol. He bandaged up his leg, got a splint, and fought back even though he had a bullet in his leg. And he kept them at bay for 3 hours, and he killed at least 18 of the North Korean-trained 5th Brigade assailants who were attacking him with full assault rifles, full webbing and so on. And he only when he ran out of ammunition, were they able to burn him out of the house, and he got through the bathroom windows, and then they beat him to death. And he ran out of ammunition. He had used all 180 rounds that he had. And the local farmers tried to help, but the police were stopping him from getting there, prevent the ambulance from reaching him until after the North Korean trained 5th Brigade finished their job. But that was the end of direct farm attacks, because Martin Olds made them pay such a high price for getting his farm that they didn't attack any other farm after that. They realized this frontal assault was not going to work. One man made the sacrifice, and he saved the lives of who knows how many other farmers. So Martin Olds is a hero to the farmers in Zimbabwe. But here, it's the wrong way around, but you can see on the left the way it used to be, on the right, the way it is today. So these are farms in Zimbabwe, what used to be great farms when it was Rhodesia, and you can just see this is what farm invasions, land reform, expropriation and compensation does. Just wrecks and ruins and weeds, and the economy is much like this vehicle, overloaded, and it's not able to sustain so much abuse. And so the latest in ambulances in Zimbabwe. And here's the latest Toyota Corolla, the Corolla. So you've got to get very innovative to be able to deliver things in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe's economy has gone from very bright in 1980 to extremely fraught today. And people can get beaten up for just praying outside a government office, or get the boot on the neck while being whipped by police in full battle gear in Zamora Michelle Avenue in downtown Harare, the capital. They want to be able to expropriate farms without compensation, where farmers have poured generations of sacrifice and hard work into cultivating the wilderness, turn them into productive farms. If they go ahead with this ill-advised policy, it will not only undermine the food security of South Africa, because no farmers, no food, no future, but famine. It'll greatly increase unemployment, chase away investors, employers, entrepreneurs, and tourists. How many people will lose their jobs if they get away with this sort of thing? Kill a boer, kill a farmer, how short-sighted is that? The economic consequences and the catastrophe that would result from this racist, lawless policy would be incalculable. It would be the final breaking of faith with the reconciliation statement made in 1994. To violate solemn international agreements to destroy the very Bill of Rights, which is meant to be the foundation for prosperity and progress in the country, would have catastrophic consequences. You cannot violate the principles of private ownership property without destroying the essential foundation for effective economies. And so, yes, it is a bit oops when he follows the policies of populism. Unintended consequences. This is a pretty well-designed meme. Prosperity is a bit of a balancing act. You want to kick the white South Africans off. What do you think is going to happen to the one doing the kicking? And here, South Africa asking for food, and the EFF saying, "No, I don't have any food for you, but at least the land is mine." So that's the consequences. This has been well documented by many good books and some excellent studies. But race hatred could destroy this great country and would destroy the last chance for Africa to show a viable, successful work economy to the world. Just reminding us of some of the farms we've got in the beautiful Western Cape. These should be protected, respected, cultivated. We need more of these farms, not less. And the people doing this are some of the finest farmers in the world. To be a farmer in South Africa, you must be some of the most resilient, tough people imaginable, and courageous at that. They need our support, they need our prayers, we need to be behind them. We don't want to join the failed states. So, any questions, any comments on...
One thing I want to say about Julius Malema is that he gives this impression that he is the popular, fearless revolutionary, but honestly the man's a coward. I mean, whenever there are EFF marches, wherever there are EFF protests, he calls the shots from his central mansion by a Zoom. And, you know, he, and also, they think that they control the narrative of racial hate and things like that. But I'm telling you, once that genie is released from the bottle, and he's going to say something, and he's going to irritate the wrong person, and all hell is going to break loose, and there's going to be no going back. You know, there's going to be no going back.
That is true.
And I mean, also, I mean, this white, the white race being, you know, exterminated. It's happening, but it's more complex and more sophisticated than what's actually being said. You know, you've got, it's a generational thing. You've got people being dumbed down, the whole white privilege and that. That's what hard is. You know, they can't exterminate. So they are dumbing down, you know, generation after generation after.
Yeah, but of course, on the other side, hard times can make strong, tough people and strong faith.
Yeah.
So when you mistreat people, it can come out of it much stronger than it would have otherwise. And I think our people who might have been sitting on their laurels in the past have had to become entrepreneurs. You don't get a nice, cushy government civil service job. You've got to be an entrepreneur. You've got to make your own work. It's got to build more character. We don't get anything for free. We don't get anything out of privilege. There's no room for entitlement. Therefore, we've got to work harder and longer.
And
some child who wants to be an engineer at a school or in business has got to work much, much harder to do it. And that's actually going to be better for them. Actually, if you hate people and want to destroy them, you give them entitlement and give them free things and make it easy. So at the end of it, what they're doing is destroying their own supporters with these policies. But the people who are being made to survive, like the farmers, are actually turning out to be some of the toughest people in the world now. So it's very counterproductive. What they're trying to do is going to make the people any stronger.
No, it's actually, I mean, they are totally unprepared for what they are trying to project. I mean, they, and I'm telling you, with this expropriation without compensation, the EFF doesn't just advocate to seize white land. All land is going to be nationalised, whether it's white land, black land, you name it. And do you think that black South Africans are just going to sit back and watch their property being taken?
They won't want to.
Exactly. So I think that there will be an all-out war breaking out, but it's not going to be white on black, as what some people are trying to. It's going to be the country united and taking on this common enemy. That's what I think.
Well, I've heard from, I don't know if the success of Prince Buthelezi feel the same, but Prince Buthelezi said if they go after land, the Zulus will stand with the Afrikaner. And I asked him personally, is this true? And he said, yes, we've got an arrangement with AfriForum and the Freedom Forum. If there's any movements against either Zulu land, the trust of the king, or Afrikaans land, they will stand together and they will fight together. So, but that was the Freedom Front, the Inkatha Freedom Party under Prince Buthelezi. I don't know if his success, because he's quite old at the moment, would stand together.
That there was this talk again.
Because there's a lot of land in KwaZulu, which is owned by the king under trust. And if the government touches that, the Zulus said there's war. And AfriForum and the Freedom Front have worked out with the Inkatha Freedom Party and Alliance that they will mutually support one another's land. this, a threat to anyone's private ownership of property can threaten everyone's. That would be a terrifying alliance from the perspective of the ANC. If the Zulu and the Afrikaners stand together, they would be hard to beat. Anyway, that's just some of the insights, but we need to understand this is what's going on. But the Bible tells us to love our neighbor, even to love our enemy, and to return good for evil, and not to return evil for good. And so we need to win our enemies to Christ, and we need to be praying for the conversion of their souls. David was a conqueror. He killed Goliath. But Jesus, more than conqueror, he took his enemy, Saul of Tarsus, a persecutor of the church, and turned to Paul the Apostle. We must aim to be more than conquerors, where we can even turn some of our potential enemies into our friends, allies, and brothers in Christ. And people are running around saying, I hate you. Well, how many here have read The Cross and Switchblade or Run, Baby, Run? What won Nicky Cruz, this horrible, merciless, murderous gang leader? There's this pastor from upstate New York, David Wilkerson, coming in. He says to Nicky Cruz, I love you. You can cut me into 1,000 pieces. Each piece will still love you. And it was his unreserved love for this gang member who is actually a horrible person. I've met Nicky Cruz too, by the way.
I remember reading and learnt about Nicky Cruz when I was at school in Auckland.
Well, it's inspiring to know that people have won their enemies before. And so we need to aim at this too. We're in a situation where they're preaching hate. And of course, as Christians, we are exactly on the opposite side. We are against hate. And by the way, would you say love is the opposite of hate? What is the opposite of love? Is the opposite of love hate? Or is the opposite of love apathy? Sometimes someone who hates you is closer to your position where you might be able to win them over than apathy. Apathy is probably the worst thing. I think somebody once showed me that apathy is worse than hate. If a person hates the gospel and is trying to fight it, you might have a chance to win them over. But a person is apathetic, that's about the worst you can have. Apathy is a problem. On the streets you get opposition. And you know, some of the opposition, you seem to have the master evangelism. Some of the opponents can get one to Christ. But the people are apathetic. They're the real problem. So let's not be too terrified of these people who are shouting the odds and screaming, kill a boer, kill a farmer. Maybe in some conversation then we might be able to win some of them over. But I don't think we'll win over many apathetic people.
Black people are some of the most divided people on earth. I mean, especially here. I have black friends who can't stand Malema. In fact, they consider him an embarrassment to black people.
They should too. Anthony, what would you add to this?
You should meet them in battle. If it comes down to that. That's all.
If it has
I don't think we can avoid it. You know, people, you know, they think that these guys are stupid. They're not. They know exactly what they're doing. They know it's going to bring the ruin of the country. They know they're going to burn all the farms. They're going to try and kill everybody. They've understood that, and they want to burn everything and start again. He's often said that. He says, you know how to live under a tree. As well. So they're not interested in economically trying to save the country. They want to absolutely destroy everything and start again. It's just a communist way, isn't it?
It is.
It's one of their, it's part of their program to destroy everything. So, you know, they're never going to stop until they achieve that agenda. You know, and people think that these guys are stupid. They're not stupid. They know exactly what they do. And they think that they can pay their price. You know, none of them fought in the war. None of them were in the war years. They fought Afrikaners. None of them have seen battle, and they know what they're talking about. So, you know, the Afrikaners, not going to let that happen.
No.
And although we might lose as many as they lost in Rwanda, or more in the initial assault, the Afrikaners ready right across the country, I can tell you that, on all levels. You know, we've seen all these military units that are ready. They're just waiting for them to start. So I've never seen guys more angry than I have now, you know, in the military, you know, that I've never seen guys so angry after this millennium, singing this kill the world, and never.
It's you know, I dangerous
think that guys now actually all talking civil war everywhere, and they're just waiting for the first shot, and then you're going to see something terrible, you know, and I'm afraid of
We need to be serious and be right with God and be ready for bad times and have extra supplies, a lot of, be networked with good community groups. By the way, this is just showing you some of the pictures of our taxi war on the go now. Do you know that the city of Cape Town has impounded over 6,400 taxis so far? And if you, I don't know where they've got a police yard big enough to park them all, but they have been going berserk impounding taxis. And the result, the blockages, I think we've all experienced some blockages on the roads, but Cape Town's never seen anything like it. People trying to get to work, queuing up, being threatened that they could lose their lives if they go on a bus. And the burning of buses, the burning of vehicles, the burning of taxis, another bus being burned. Three buses in a row all burning at the same time. Fire brigade's been super busy lately. This is on the N2. And our so-called Minister of Police, or Commissioner of Police, and the fights on the streets. Cape Town is in a taxi war. And by the way, there are more taxis in Cape Town than there are police, traffic police, and a metro police combined. But you confiscate 6,000 people's vehicles and means of employment and income. What do you think is going to happen? So this is a war. This is not a strike, this is a war. It's a taxi war. And this is going on all around Cape Town right now. What actually is he firing there, do you think? Tear gas smoke or something?
Yeah, rubber bullets or whatever. That's tear gas, I think.
Massage. Well, it is meant to work with R4 and R1s as well, but it didn't. The witch doctors didn't have a very high success rate.